Traditionally, in Tibet, there's in Mongolia, there's two celebrations. There's Losar, which means New Year, and then there's Monlam, which is the prayer festival that takes place during or at the end of the two-week New Year's. We just got one New Year's Day, right? official day. Monlam means like aspiration, and Lam means path, so the path of developing aspiration or inspiration. The prayer festival in Tibet was started by Lama Tsongkhapa, who is the founder of our particular style, Dalai Lama style. He wanted to get everyone together, to work together to create aspirations for getting along. So some people say it's because he saw all the Tibetans partying too much, drinking too much cheer, you know, chang, beer. That's probably more, you know, Western style, like seeing Tsongkhapa is kind of a little puritanical, like don't have too much fun. It's really more like wanting to bring people together, you know, so bring all the different traditions, the different schools together to create harmonious relationships and create good aspirations. So sometimes there are long processions, and famously there'd be huge butter sculptures made. I don't know if that's happening this year in Lhasa and the Jokhang or not, but maybe at some point, if it's cold enough, we'll make some butter sculptures, you know, like that. Some people already made those, so a little bit here, maybe. Later on in the service, we're going to read through a very traditional prayer called King of Prayers, which is done generally at New Year's times and at Monlam. And then also, I handed out a teaching I've given before, but maybe it was a Monday night, I'm not sure. Four legs of Dharma table. So even in Monlam, traditionally, there's a teaching, so that's what you're going to get today. Who's here for the first time? Some people? Yeah. Hello, welcome. Hope this meets some of your needs. The four legs of the Dharma table the example, a metaphor for us to check our wisdom mind, to check how we can trust what we're seeing and experiencing. Generally, the biggest problem we find human beings is our trust has been broken somehow. As kids, we have kind of kid trust, right? We just have unconditional trust. We take everything in. We actually just believe everything. Usually that actually works pretty well, because we have to believe it to learn. We just identify with the world. We have to, the first experience is one of identification. And we return to that in the highest teachings of Mahamudra and Dzogchen, seeing the nature of mind. The problem is, at some point, earlier or later, something goes wrong. So we both develop a mistaken socialized self, and generally we have some kind of trauma or problem. You know, samsara hits us the side of the head with a 4x4. Samsara is the cycle of suffering. So human beings, in a way, evolve, in a sense, kind of naturally, a misperceived self, one that's kind of fixated and not entirely correct. And then on top of that, we have some kind of trauma that happens that draws us away from our sense of unconditioned world. I'm using the term trauma for what would normally be talked about as the ripening of negative karma, right? So the misperceived self, the mistake we make out of just a naturally occurring ignorance, plus the results of negative karma, generally mean that we've formed some kind of mistrust, usually unconscious, but mistrust nonetheless. Usually, we kind of do okay with that. I'd say, you know, majority of people actually, in some weird way, do okay. They just form coping skills. They get along with a sense of normal and normal ups and downs, and they're not interested in looking and seeing what's going on. But some of us become curious, like maybe there's a better way, maybe we don't have to, maybe we want to wake up from misperceived self, maybe we want to overcome the pain. Generally what happens is we start some kind of search, and generally the search is an attempt to return to unconditioned trust, unconditioned world, open world, complete love, complete truth, complete trust. If we don't receive any wisdom from a guide or from inside, generally we're going to try to recreate the childlike world. However, in our teachings, we can't recreate the childlike world of innocence. We can't go backwards. The attempt to recreate it is what's called Trungpa Rinpoche, called spiritual materialism. We try to recreate like Dharma Disneyland or some kind of perfectionist ideal within. We figure, well, maybe if we're perfect, then we can return to that unconditional trust place. However, in our tradition, we say that actually doesn't work and brings about more frustration to try to go backwards. So the Buddha taught we have to go forward to wisdom trust. We have to go forward to using our intelligence so that we actually know what's going on. We actually know how to investigate. We actually know how to see for our own. We actually come to our own experience. And then we have true trust based on knowledge, on wisdom. We have true unconditional wisdom, love, true unconditional trust. It's a very difficult path. So that's why we have lots of teachings and teachers and support from Lama, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha like that. So this is the four legs of the Dharma table is to talk about how we can attain wisdom trust like that. Maybe we should stop for a second and see. Brian has a microphone. If someone has a, like, before I go on, maybe there's a, we could have kind of question and answer today. If I'm being totally clear, you don't have to ask any questions. You know. You're totally clear? Okay, good. All right. Oh, I'm clear. Okay. We're doing good, huh? Okay.
Can I ask a question? What are you making a distinction between
Do you want to add the microphone to it? Yeah, just this could be a good question. It's possible.
Thank you, Lamala. Why are we making a distinction between number two teachers and lineage and guidance from Lama, number three? How are those different?
Well, I'm going to go into that in a minute, yeah. So, but does it make sense about how we are wounded or lose our trust or get confused growing up and then we try to recreate that? Does that make sense? So we're on the same page. Okay. So I'll get into that right now. That's a good question. If it's on the mic, do the questions go into the recording, Brian? Yeah, that's nice, yeah.
Lamala, could you say a few more words about spiritual materialism?
Yeah, this is was Trungpa Rinpoche's term for the self trying to maintain a knowledge through doing dharma or spiritual means. In other words, he used the term like ego tries to turn spiritual practices into a way of fortifying itself. So, my favorite one is we're very interested in being seen to be humble or something. Yeah, we're proud of being humble. Yeah, something like that. we want to be perceived as good Dharma practitioners, you know, all the time, like that. It's a phenomenon that, of course, is always there, but Trungpa Rinpoche commented on it in his first book that came out in the early 70s because he met a lot of spiritual hippies at the time in 1969, 68. So I was one of them, so I get it, you know. The other piece about it is the spiritual materialism has to do with the shopping mentality. So not just the innate kind of way we distort spiritual religious truths, but he was kind of making fun of or pointing out the consumer-based approach to yoga and spirituality that he saw in America, like that. Self-improvement ideals, perfectionist ideals of spiritual growth, the sales aspect to teachings. We're very much part of a consumer society, and we have to kind of render unto Caesar what's Caesar's. We have to have 501c3, and we have to have accountant, and we have to pay mortgage here, and maybe you've already been asked for some kind of donations or something, and we'll probably ask you again. But the shopping idea is based on hunting, so we hunt the Dharma and hunt the Lama. So we kind of mining. It's like mining. You go find what you want, and then you take it and you leave. So the spiritual materialism has that kind of colonization of our community and colonization of our Buddha nature, where we go in and we take it and we leave. You know, that it's kind of that colonization model. So it's an important term because it goes to the consumer quality that we naturally have, and also the sense of hypocrisy in spiritual practice. But it's kind of inevitable. We can't say, "Well, I've stamped." I had one student a long time ago say, I think I've stamped out my spiritual materialism. So that's, you know, always kind of iffy, right? You know, we have to, that's like saying your glasses will never get dusty or something. So it's like in 12-step recovery, we usually say we're recovering. You know, we don't try to make some kind of final thing like that. I could go on and fear this a lot. This is a good question, you know, because the spiritual materialism, but at the same time, we if we create the right aspirations, which we're here to talk about today, called bodhicitta in Sanskrit, the spirit of awakening, then that cuts through. So the title of Trungpa Rinpoche's book was Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, not just giving into it or screwed, you know. So so what it cuts through spiritual materialism is what's called bodhicitta, the spirit or the heart mind of awakening, which generally starts with the felt sense that you can't bear to see yourself and others suffering. You know, that you just it starts with that, you know, just that altruistic outpouring. That's a natural part of our very being to, you know, help others like that. So that cuts through that sense of spiritual materialism. Yes. Yeah, bodhicitta develops ultimately into a compassionate activity. So you just want to do something about it. You want to create situations where you can help people overcome unnecessary suffering, and then also prevent it too, not just you know, wait until the horse is out of the barn. But so. You know, bodhicitta and the aspiration practices are that, you know, like the beginning and the end, the alpha and omega, like that. But many times when people want to benefit others, they're not sure, you know, whether there's still a lot of doubt, right? We don't know, like, even when that spirit arises, maybe we're thinking, we don't know how to help people properly. We don't see the situation properly. We don't know if we're making a bigger mess. You know, we don't know whether being like, you know, slobbering codependents or something. So we also need a wisdom mind, right? So compassion and wisdom, which sees the situation correctly and wants to benefit others, are the two wings of the Dharma bird, the Dharma eagle. Lots of times, eagle is just kind of an aside, and Tibetan is a translation for vulture, you know, because they like vultures, but we don't like it in the West. So, you know, we say eagle, and it's really like a huge vulture. They're vultures still, right? And weren't they down at Sequoia National or Kings? Where the vultures hang out in California? Are they in Death Valley? Yeah. Have you ever seen a vulture? They're really incredible, right? Yeah. They're just vultures right here, too? Oh, good. Okay. They're circling maybe right now. Yeah. So that's good. Yeah, it's like Garuda, the mythical vulture, you know. Yeah. One more? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want you to digress too much from the teachings. But I was thinking about spiritual materialism. Is there a relationship between that and the debate between secular Buddhism versus traditional Buddhism?
Secular,
traditional. Yeah, because you were saying something, you know, the spiritual materialism could kind of perpetuate some of the pick and choose type of practices that people in the West engage in. you know, in terms of Buddhism. I read a fascinating article that made a big argument between secular Buddhism and traditional Buddhism, particularly here in the West, and it seemed to make seemed to find a connection between that and spiritual materialism. Maybe there isn't.
Well, actually, way here at Dona Dargé Lion's Roar, we do both. So we have mindfulness evenings like Tuesday and Wednesday, right, and also some mornings. We're still doing some mornings here, 8 to 9. Yeah, so just sitting, right? Yeah. Actually, through Lion's Roar Dharma Center, which is our whole kind of mandala, yeah, we do what might be called secular Buddhism, and we do lineage Buddhism too, the same, you know. The important thing is the bodhicitta aspect. You know, if it's there. If secular Buddhists say we're the right way and everyone else is wrong, I'll criticize them. If lineage Buddha said the only right way is super against, you know, this is the only right way, then I'll criticize that, right? We want to have the middle way. if you're doing any practice, whether it's Vipassana up to Tantra and Dzogchen, if there's no bodhicitta, you're not doing it. It's just gymnastics. It's not even gymnastics. You're actually making it worse. That's the weird part. You know, we can't absolutely say, you know, this is just by the outer form. Because people come here and they go, well, this can't be real Buddhism, because real Buddhism the Buddha didn't have tankas or something, you know. They get the Protestant kind of rationalistic kind of thing. I was a religion major, so we study these things. Or then other people come in, well, this is real Buddhism because they really have tankas and altars, you know. But but they're real. but here at Lion's Roar, you know, we've trying to steer middle way, so we have innovative, maybe innovative secular kind of approach, psychological secular combined with mythological and religious and together. So we're doing it all, huh?
The whole enchilada,
yeah. So it's a vegetarian enchilada, probably. I don't know, just kidding. Yeah, so that's a good question. Yeah. Okay.
Chant for material things, you know, that's obviously on one side of the fence.
Bodhicitta, we talk about absolute and relative bodhicitta that go together. You know, relative bodhicitta has a particular aim, you know, like I want, you know, to create this particular person or situation to blossom and be free, and absolute bodhicitta is completely unconditioned. So those two always go together. It's the weird world that Jada Rinpoche talked so eloquently about just a couple of weeks ago, that the conditioned world, the kind of made-up world, and the unconditioned world totally exist in harmony together. It's just completely weird. So when we're developing bodhicitta, we have an intention that has maybe a limit or a relation to something else, and at the same time it's completely unlimited because there's no particular person making the intention, and there's no particular outcome. But overall, we could say there bodhicitta is this absolute, unconditional intention like that, and that's the most important. So, but in the intention, there's always going to be some kind of wisdom mind, whether it's relative or absolute wisdom, so to speak, and like that. So, in our tradition, we do formal traditional trainings that teachers have used for their own realization, but also anything we do with bodhicitta is going to turn into a training and a practice. So many people have come to realizations in our tradition through doing practices that seemed a little bit eccentric for the tradition, you know, but because they had, you know, bodhicitta, then it worked. Where other people, they're doing looks like they're doing everything by the book, kind of, so to speak, but there's not the freedom, the unconditioned freedom mind, so it stays kind of contained like that. It's interesting. There's a gentleman here in the green. Yeah.
Thank you, Lamala.
Doing great. Yeah.
What you were speaking about earlier about wanting to go back to that childlike place is something that I deal with a lot. Always wanting to go back to that place. But particularly, I'm struggling in my practice because a loved one of mine recently died. And I find that nothing quite makes you want to go back to that childlike place, like facing a crisis like that. And I'm struggling to come back to my practice full-heartedly because of a lot of the sadness and fear and anger I have myself right now. And I'm just wondering if you might be able to help me with that or say some words.
I'm sorry to hear that. So
thank you.
Please accept. From highest tantra viewpoint, you see, we don't have to go back to childlike place because we haven't left it. You see, there's a mistake that we've actually left it. It's just that by constricting ourselves, kind of like, you know, putting a crimp in our garden hose, so to speak, we miss out on it. You know, so when we grow into a kind of what I'm calling just adult wisdom mind, we never lose the childlike innocence, really, you see. So in a sense, it was a mistake that it ever got lost or misplaced. So that's one of the wounds. We think we're broken and effed up and bad, stupid, and wrong, right? So we try to recreate something that's already there. But we do, you know, we do see the differences biologically and just conventionally between children and adults, right? We have the ability to problem solve and to see a bigger perspective and see shadow sides of things that kids don't. So actually, we keep the child, we nurture the child within us at the same time that we're growing, you know, our grown-up side. So we never leave it. So we want to keep that, you know, going. So we could say that the adult becomes the parent to the child in a good way. So some of us have like finished maybe reading a little pitch here, Lincoln in the Bardo. It's a hard book to figure out what's going on there, but it's this story about how Abraham Lincoln lost his son, Willie, who was like, I don't know, 11 or something during Civil War, and then grieving it, and it's kind of mystical. But anyway, I think if I read it properly, the child, with help from the other kind of dead spirits of the cemetery, come back into Abraham Lincoln, and then he's able to release his child, something like that. Did I get that right? Yeah, I don't know, you know, what the heck happened in the book, you know, it's probably just like anything, but we don't abandon the child. We move forward to provide the child more support. So we don't really grow up the child, we grow more like trees, right? We don't try to grow up the child, we just grow the more rings like that. Yeah, there's a lot more to say. Thank you. Oh, okay.
Could you explain to me what bodhicitta is? I'm new to this here.
Bodhicitta,
bodhicitta,
like the animal cheetah. So like that. Yeah, cheetah means a hard mind in Sanskrit, and bodhi means awake. So the bodhicitta is the wish and aspiration and activity of helping others to be free, awake, and happy, and ourselves to be free, awake, and happy. And it's come motivated by we just can't bear to. We can't bear others' suffering. We can't bear our own suffering, really. It's unacceptable. We can't say, well, that's the way it is, or there'll always be idiots, or there'll always be poor people, or I'll always be a mess. You know, it's very active-oriented. But it comes from a deep sense of we have to do something. It's not acceptable. So, like, if we get a very simple, but if you get a speck of dust in your eye, you want to take it out right away, right? You don't want to bear it, right? Yeah. So if you get a speck of dust in your eye, you don't say, well, this is a lesson, or, well, this is good for me, or, well, it's supposed to be there, right? You just want to take it out right away. There's no, right? Yeah, you know, but from the, you know, from unbearable suffering, others' emotional suffering, our own, other physical, you know, suffering, biological suffering, that we want to overcome it. From the Buddhist point of view, that there's no value in, you know, this, what we call suffering. That's brought about through malice or hate or misknowledge. There's no value in that. So we want to overcome it as quickly as possible. Does that make sense? That makes sense, yeah. So another kind of style, spiritual materialism, briefly, is you know, Jada Rinpoche talked about it a little bit, you know. There was a question about someone's illness, and he said, well, I really have nothing to say to you, because when we're feeling great, we have all kinds of advice when the other person's ill, right? We just, you know, like, hey, it's okay. You know, I call it Job's friends, you know, Book of Job. Job's, yeah, you know, well, you must have done something wrong, or did you try this, and like that. And In Dharma practice, we're trying very energetically to remove unnecessary suffering. We can't remove pain, or, you know, we can't remove things that happen, but we can remove suffering that's caused by misknowledge from human beings. We can remove suffering that's caused by not taking care of our world, you see, like that. So there's no value. We don't say this is the, we don't say, well, in Dharma, we don't say stuff like, you know, this is a good learning. I mean, we joke, we say, well, that's good practice sometimes, but actually it's not, you know. There's no value in someone in suffering. There's value in waking up. There's value in overcoming it. It's not devalued in the sense that it's meaningless, but we don't have to learn any more lessons on the planet, right? Does anybody want to learn any more lessons? No, you don't? Haven't you gotten it? Yeah, so like that. Never would the Buddha say, okay, this is, it's, you're going to have to learn from your suffering. There's no Schadenfreude. You know what I'm saying? You know Schadenfreude? Like, well, you know, so sometimes people use karma that way, like, well, you had it coming to you, that was your karma. We never really say that, you know, that's, we might think it, but it's not really, that would be spiritual materialism, like, your karma bit your butt, so, you know. But, oh, we don't really wish that. I know, it's hard. Schadenfreude. Not at all. That's the opposite of what I'm trying to say.
I don't understand.
We can comfort others. We should try to comfort others. We're just not lecturing others.
Okay.
Right? That's pretty shitty, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, somebody's lecturing and go, you know, you should just realize everything's impermanent, so let go.
Yeah.
You know, that's lecturing, right? You know, get over it, you know, like that. We're not doing that. Of course, we're trying to be comforting, absolutely. It's hard to always be comforting. There's no, like, this is always the comfort words to use. This, you know, it's tricky. It's, you know, very, you know, I like, of course, I'm a licensed psychotherapist, too, and lots of trainings, and some people say, you know, you should never be sympathetic, never say you're sorry, but sometimes you should say you're sorry, you know? Like, that's kind of like, you know, there are too many tropes of what you should say and not say. You know, just say something, you know, that if it comes from bodhicitta, you know, then, you know, if it comes out awkward, then you can say, well, wow, that came out really awkward, and I'm trying to be comforting here, and maybe I'm a jerk, you know, but, you know, like that, right? Otherwise, we become these weird perfectionist bodhisattva, kind of trying to be empathy Pema Chodron people, you know, and you don't want to do that, you know. Don't make yourself into like trying to just kind of say, wow, can I, you know, like that's bad, or can I do anything to help, or can I get you a glass of water, or do you want me to adjust your pillow or something? Try something, right? Yeah, that's important. Okay. Bala. Hi.
Suppose whatever you tried never works.
Well,
it
what's
just,
working?
You can't get through. I mean, there's very little that works. You try very hard to help.
You mean works to change the other person?
To help them.
Yes. So developing the bodhicitta, it always works because it's working on us. It's always working. It doesn't work exactly as fast as we want it to work. That's the difference.
So just trust in it and keep doing it, even though you don't see any results, really.
Absolute bodhicitta is we just keep throwing the jello against the wall, and the wall gives up eventually. But it usually... not very often is it totally on our timeline, you see. That's the difficult part. You know, we always want the results to happen within a short time frame, within the timeline, you know. And that's of course, grieving. I always want to see, you know, the results happen within the timeline. So my timeline and theirs, right? And that's the difficult part.
Patience.
Yeah, I wouldn't lecture patience, but it is the paramita of patience. It's knowing it's patient because we know that that it has an effect. But it's not comforting to say it may not have an effect this lifetime. It's a wisdom fact that it may not, but it will, you know. But we want to see it quickly, of course. So we always make prayers, may it quickly happen. But there's no one of the faiths that many people have lost. They think, well, the goodness we do gets destroyed or has no effect, right? You know, we start having doubts. We think it's, you know, it doesn't seem to be happening. The wrong people seem to be prospering, and the good people seem to be going under or something. Or, you know, good people seem to be getting sick, and bad people seem to be just fine. Things like that. So. It takes a deep bodhicitta to feel our radiance, so to speak. To feel our own radiance of bodhicitta. it's fundamentally, first, it is fundamentally helping us. So the practice of bodhisattva is that we realize that that we can continue to give gift of happiness when others are suffering. We're making a pledge in bodhicitta as bodhisattvas. Sattva means being, right? That we are going to be happy in the midst of suffering. We're going to share our happiness, strength, you know, experience and hope, as we say in 12 step, like that. Because at some point we want to identify with someone suffering. If they're suffering, we want to suffer too, right? But actually we have to share. So if someone's dying, and this is a Dharma idea anyway. You don't have to agree with me, but if we're visiting someone in the hospital and they're dying and they ask us how we're doing, what should we say? If we're doing great, we should say we're doing great. Right? Yeah, they're like, well, they're vented, or they're got tubes, or you know, or they're just getting infusions, and well, how do you, oh gosh, I'm having a really good day today. After this, I'm going for lunch at my favorite place, and then I'm going for the beach. That's bodhisattva stuff, and then share our happiness with them about that. Does that seem cruel or weird? Yeah. We might be feeling crappy too. It's okay to say I'm feeling crappy too. But if you're not, we can all just say, I'm sad. I'm torn up that someone is sick, and then at the same time, we're very happy too. All of Dharma practice is like we're stubbing our toe at the same time we're seeing the Grand Canyon, right? This is simultaneously openness and stubbing your toe is too true. It's like this horror at the same time, this complete freedom and happiness. We're seeing both simultaneously. It doesn't go away. The horror doesn't go away. That's the real tantra aspect. It doesn't go away. We're not here to fix the death piece or the impermanence piece, where it takes its place. The big question. Difficult, yeah. I don't know if I have time for the rest of the talk now, but it's okay. The four legs, traditionally, so we're just, if we're trying to, see into the nature of things, our motivation, the situation, nature of mind and phenomena, whatever you want to say, it's natural that we first say, what did Shakyamuni have to say? We actually check it out. So in our tradition, reality is what a Buddha sees. This is important for a scientific materialist. That's it. Reality is what no one sees, but is there anyway through the microscope. Reality is what an enlightened being sees. That's reality. There's not an objective reality outside. Absolute reality is what an enlightened being sees. It takes a long time to see how that's true, because we're educated in scientific materialism that says reality must be something completely different than what, people see, right? But reality is totally what enlightened being sees. That's absolute reality. This should not seem obvious at all, but that's the way the tradition sees it.
So if that's absolute reality, then what, for ultimate reality, what is an enlightened being see?
That's absolute ultimate, Ultimate's kind of union of, absolute just kind of dharmakaya. This is a little technical, but an ultimate, you see the relative and the unconditioned at the same time. Just the way a Buddha sees the world is the way things actually are. Then Then we look at the second. We look at what other people have said, you know, just what have other people done, you know. So that's, we always think we're reinventing the wheel, but other people have had similar experiences. So, you know, what does logic say? So we train in logic in our tradition. What is common sense, you know? So we read the biographies, we check with other people, we talk to our friends, we talk to teachers. You know, we're not arrogant, we just ask, well, what did you do about this or that? Then third, personal guidance. So Shakyamuni is wonderful, lineage and logic. Teachers, like through books, it's wonderful, but they don't talk back to us. So we all need some personal guidance, somebody that actually knows our personal history and situation. Somebody that, you know, can speak directly to our situation. And then fourth, direct experience. We're that's actually, you know, the most important, right? But those, hopefully those four kind of line up, you know, so the table has equal feet or legs or something. So the doesn't wobble. Yeah, it doesn't wobble. Yeah, balance. Yeah. Like that. So then I have that. Then the table is balanced so you can use it. So things are interdependent, cooperation, co-arising and dissolving, free and connected. So you have complete openness because the table, you can put anything on the table, right? And then completely supportive at the same time. So then you have this kind of, you have this certainty that isn't arrogant. It's built on experience. It's built on checking it out. It's built on checking it out with other people. But fundamentally, you've tasted the water too. You can see the sky is blue too, right? It's verified through your own direct experience. But it's also checked out, you know, because many people claim to have direct experience and they're a little bit psychotic, right? So in our tradition, we check things out. This feels a little dry, doesn't it? But it's, no, it doesn't. Oh, thanks for saying that. It doesn't feel dry to me, yeah. There's a question here.
Can you say a little bit more about the part where it says both free and connected?
Yeah, so that's the experiential sense, you know? The experiential sense is we feel connected with everything, but we don't feel enmeshed or bound, you know? So that's what everybody wants. We want the complete freedom so we don't feel constricted, but we don't want to feel isolated. We don't want to feel, like, abandoned. But at the same time, we don't want to feel engulfed either. We don't want to feel trapped, right? Because everyone either, I'm either trapped or I'm abandoned, right? So the middle way is we're connected and free at the same time. When it's a felt sense, you know.
Yeah, what I'm seeing is that the supports are the scriptures, the Dharma, the lineage, the teachers there, and then here we are having our direct experiences.
Yep.
So within the structure of the lineage or the structure of this process that's supposed to help us feel free? I mean, I can see where it could make us feel connected because here we are, we're part of an organization, we feel connected. I know Michelle, everybody knows everybody else. But how do we feel free within a structure that can sometimes seem rigid? It could be interpreted as being rigid.
Well, that's why the tabletops, you can put anything on the table. See, the structure supports openness. That's the interesting part. Yeah.
I don't know if I would maybe disagree with, like, sometimes the structure doesn't allow for openness, especially. Sometimes. Well, okay, it's not a table, then it's a bookshelf, or I don't know.
But yeah. Well, when you have, you know, when we're talking about structure here, we're talking about enlightened structure, right? We're not talking about, you know, misperceived structure or samsaric structure. We're talking about actual, you know, real structure that's helpful, of course, mm-hmm. that actually exists, you know.
So when you're saying when all four are balanced and in line with each other and checking each other out, the options are there, the freedom of options to put on the table whatever you want to put on the table, metaphorically.
In a sense, it's just a sense of openness that is grounded at the same time, you know, like that. So it's a stable openness, actually. See, like many times, you know, people just go back and forth between the extremes. You know, they're too tight, or then they get too loose, right? So too loose, we're just kind of don't have any grounding or any reference points, or we're like a cannonball on an old ship, you know, in the sea going back and forth. Or we're too rigid, you know, where everything's nailed down and we can't move. So real structure isn't either one. So it's not the rigid structure of nailing things down, and it's not the, you know, just out of control openness. It's the middle way. Yeah, good. These are the important questions, right? This is it, you know. Yeah, good.
Are you talking about one taste?
One taste. It's kind of Dharma term, one taste. It is one taste. You know, we say, the Buddha said, my teaching has one taste, like the ocean has one taste, the taste of salt. It's liberation. So it's liberation from any fixed views, you know. So it's interesting, when we don't have fixations, then there's a natural sense of harmony and structure and openness. That's what's really interesting. So it isn't chaotic and it's not rigid. It has a natural kind of openness. So that's the one taste of liberation. Like that. So hopefully here, lines are we're doing, you know, liberation, Dharma, like that. But the liberation is this interesting mature liberation, right? It's not just acting out liberation, but real open. Isn't it nice? Feels good. Hi.
How do you share the Dharma without coming across to other people as like judgy or preachy, or like, I know all these things and my table is so solid, like, what, you know, here's what I know. How do you do that?
Basically, you're just saying, well, here's what I'm doing and you decide, you know, to others. When it gets down to it, you know, you're just saying, well, I get up in the morning and I'm trying to do this, you know, and you let me know how you think it's working for you. Really, you know. So it's a kind of a come and see kind of thing, you know, like that. So, or like that, you know. So, you know, it is an attraction, not, you know. If somebody asks us, you know, we can say, you know, really, you should, I mean, I just tell people, like, well, I was worse, right? And sometimes people are like, I can't imagine that you were worse, but no, I was worse. Yeah, so, you know, usually it's just, you know, we're keeping towards, we're just our own personal testimonial, you know, we're just sharing our experience, strength, and hope, you know, we're just saying this has been my experience of working with myself and other people that found this, we can say that, you know. But generally it doesn't help to be preachy anyway, although it's very tempting. I mean, it is tempting. You know, you should, you know, you'd be better if you meditated or something or like that, but I'm not against giving advice. Yes. That's it. So Mark Twain said, you know, there's no reason not to give advice because it's not taken anyway. So don't worry. Yeah, good question. Javier, yeah. So, yeah, that's good. Yeah. We're getting this down. Yeah, it's good.
Testing. Can you say a bit more about the interdependent cooperation? I take it that relates to like interdependent origination, that kind of theory. And I guess, like these four things sort of help break that negative cycle and then turn the wheel towards the more transcendental interdependent origination, or maybe I'm just over-intellectualizing it. Say something on that.
If we have to talk about things at all, you know, if we have to talk about beings or things, you know, if we're starting on the being or thing language, you know, which is most of language, being and things and discrete emotions and objects, like I am angry with you or I love you. Those are like I and then emotion and you, right? So if we're using that kind of way of talking, which itself is a construct, we should realize that they're all totally so relative to each other. They can't be separate things. But we don't always have to talk in reification language, right? So we don't always have to say, "I am going to the store. I feel like this about you. You feel like this about me." But if we're going to use that kind of language, then we have to recognize that the whole structure exists as one piece, and doesn't, you know, we can't have an I without a you, right? So if we're going to use the language structure in that way, we have to recognize it's interdependent. But we can use traditionally, like mantras are non-reification language. So, you know, to say om, you know, it's not om what, it's just like that. Or ah, you know, like San Dzogchen is ah. There's no reference point outside of it, right? There's no subject-object, actually. But as long as we're talking subject-object, we would have to say subject-object are interdependent, right? But if we're not talking subject and object, then what's that world? Like that. So that's really the world that you have to demonstrate to me, to your teacher. You have to demonstrate. Do you know what that non-dualistic world is? Or at least can you actually express it? Or do you even if you do express it in subject-object world, do you talk about it knowingly that we're expressing? You know, we're expressing a subject-object duality. We're hip to that. But that's always interesting, is the non-subject-object expression. So four legs aren't really separate. Take one leg away, you know, and don't have the table. Yeah. Important questions. So we're almost out of time, you know. These are good questions, so I've gone on. So we'll have to save King of Prayers. You're looking at King of Prayers. So this do this. You visualize, okay, because you don't have time. You visualize that all the aspirations have entered your crown chakra and you've attained this wonderful aspiration to benefit all beings and be free and help them be free, right? Okay? Yeah? Did you get it? Yeah. And then we'll ask for them back, you know. Because the aspiration's free, but the paper isn't, you know, something like that. So I think maybe Susan's already said something about Donna, did you? Yeah, so we've worked very hard at the temple here to do it a traditional way so that we really do run exclusively on voluntary donations. This is the traditional way to do it, so we're not like this costs this. You know, people make monthly pledges and people give here, but the emphasis is on a voluntary instead of a transaction, right? So we're trying, that's why people sometimes, you know, when they see a lama, they put things in red envelopes, so you see it as a gift rather than a transaction or a fee, like that, you know, so that we feel good about what we're doing and like that. And, you know, we've started doing sometimes Zambala mantra. I don't know if we're ready to do that today, but Zambala is the Buddha of spiritual wealth. So most of the time people feel a little bit of, they're jealous of their spiritual energy, right? Like we feel like if we give too much, we might lose it. So here in our tradition, we realize that our spiritual wealth like is unlimited. There's no end to bodhicitta, right? You're not going to run out. But we do the training and the practice to, on a relative level, to increase our container, right? So even though the water is unlimited, you know, the holder can be a thimble or it could be an ocean, right? So the same water, right? But, you know, from in our just small human life, we're always trying as Dharma practitioners to be as big a water carrier as possible. Who are the Aquarians in this room? Like the water carriers? Any Aquarians? Yeah, water carrier, right? You're carrying water. Okay, so please, maybe next Sunday, I don't know if we're ready. We're going to actually, next Sunday, I'm here, we'll be prepared. We're going to try passing our little basket so people get the idea, just showing, you know, putting a dollar in the basket and doing that. Would that be okay with people? Yeah, you know, because sometimes when newcomers come, they don't know. And I want people to see, even people that are giving $1,000 a month, you know, just, you know, business-wise, you know, just putting a dollar, and then we see that every time it's a gift. We experience our experience as gift like that. Good work, Brian. We got through the questions. Yeah, okay.
I am the volunteer coordinator. If anybody would love that microphone, let me know. Michelle. So we had just a Sangha meeting yesterday. We talked about a couple of cool things that are coming up. And one was movie night, and it'll be held in the back dojo. And we're going to start in April. Like most things here, it takes a lot of energy, a lot of manpower, or people power, I guess. So there are going to be speakers and projectors and non-microwavable popcorn, I think was explicit. So we're going to have a festive evening in the back. Javier here is the lead person on that, so please bombard him with your enthusiasm and all your volunteer efforts. We're also, Dirk, he's going to be starting a quarter moon practice. I'm not sure what that is, so you're talking to the wrong person, but Dirk or anybody else in the Sangha will know about that.
in our audio dharma that we've been working on, all these talks are recorded. We've been trying to get them up on the website, and we think we figured out how to do that. So instead of getting a Google Drive, they're going to be up on the website, which is a lot more accessible, and we'll be able to download them as MP3 straight to your devices. So that's our goal, thanks.
Very good. So we'll do closing prayers, and generally I go back and sit in the tower office, but I like people to come in and say hello like that. So sometimes more than one person, I like Buddhist style is like people just hang out and say hi, so it isn't like one-to-one interview. People just sit there and I say hi and then say hi to the next person. Does that make sense? So I like to meet people and say hello. That's good. You ready? Okay. Yeah, good. Mirror to these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, now has risen, not diminish but increase more and more. In the land is circled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chenrezi Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. May our teachings remain forever. May all migrators achieve happiness. And they may fulfill all their temporary and ultimate goals. Dashvara, great treasure of objectless compassion, Manjushri, master of flawless wisdom, Anupani, Dhanaya Vanyaya, Osamaras, Ankapa, crown jewels, snowy land sages, Losang Drakpa, and crest to churn feet. Just one thing I remembered is one of our members loves making malas, mantra beads, and the short kind that go around the wrist and then longer kind, and we have those in the tea room area, and we need a volunteer to have like a nice way to accept the donations, you know. So I don't know, you know, when you donate to the temple and you get a mala, then you have a nice spiritual connection. So Deborah would be really gratified to see those disappear also. So you could say, as a gift also. But, I think, once again, you know, we don't like put price on it, but, you know, it'd be nice to like, I know if you go on the enchanted garden place in Old Sacramento. Anybody been to those old, that hippie shop? Yeah, you know. So probably it'd be at least $10 for a nice mala like that, right? So that would be nice. But we need like little basket to accumulate. So if people come through and you see a mala, then put some money in the basket, and it helps Lion's Roar. And then the person making them feels really good too. And then you'll do some mani mantra, right? Om mani padme hum. So also I'd like to wish good wishes for Michael from Mexico. So I know you'll be taking off before too long, right?
Yeah, a couple days.
And ask Michael to, start doing dharma with friends there. So we need an international center, right?
Yeah.
No, Yeah. Well, let's have a shared fantasy. Then we can share. Okay.
It's on Mexican time.
Uh-huh, okay, good. All right. Omaha. Thank you, everyone.